I'd like to thank Thomas for a fantastic review. In fact, makes most of my talk redundant. But I'll start by telling you how I came to be here. So Rakesh contacted me sometime before the meeting and said that we're really working on the Tantalite project, but we don't want to talk about that. But we're tuning into that. And I know you're doing some good monitoring of the contact rate, but I don't want to talk about that. But we're tuning into that. I'll give a review of the eager here. I'll make sure that nothing is missed from what we left with eager. So that's why Rakesh asked me to give this talk before Fermi met Dan, giving him a good title for it. But then looking at the participants for this meeting, most of the key players in the eager era are here. They know what they did better than I do. So I'm not going to give the considered, insightful, thoughtful review like the kind of promise. I'm better to touch on a few points of key to me, I guess, from eager. But before doing that, I want to talk a little bit about some 50th anniversary celebrations this year. We had a meeting at Parkes last week to celebrate 50 years of the Parkes Radio Telescope. Marking the opening, or 50 years from the opening, Google in Australia at least had as their banner, it's a bit dark, but the 64-metre, another telescope on site, as the Google banner. And it's, in fact, incredible what Parkes has achieved over its 50 years. In the first couple of years of the telescope's existence, it confirmed linear polarization in extragalactic sources, confirming that synchrotron radiation was where the non-thermal radiation radio emission was coming from. Detected Faraday rotation for the first time in Centaurus A. By studying Faraday rotation as a function of galactic latitude and longitude, confirmed that there is a galactic magnetic field, influencing things. Lunar occultations of 3C273 led to the discovery of quasars, and that was all just in the first couple of years of the telescope's life. And then in the 1960s, there was an all-sky survey, all-southern sky survey at 408 megahertz. In the 1970s, 2.7 gigahertz. And then in the 1990s, the PNN survey at 4.8 gigahertz, which I'll come back to. Parkes today has a very strong connection to Fermi, and not so much with the AGM, but through the pulsar observations. Parkes has the enviable record of having discovered about two-thirds of the known pulsars, and roughly two-thirds of the observing time of Parkes at the moment is used for some kind of pulsar observation, be that timing known pulsars, following up Fermi detections, which is proving to be a good way of discovering new millisecond pulsars, or blind surveys, an all-sky survey for new pulsars. Parkes is so famous that it was for a time pictured on the $50 note in Australia. Ian Clunies Ross, who was head of CSIRO for a while, there's the Parkes dish. These are some pulses from the first pulsar observed on Parkes, a map of the LMC, the Kalgoorlie radio heliograph with an image of the sun. So Australians carried more scientific knowledge around their wallets than they probably understood. But why am I banging on about 50 years of Parkes? Well, there's a nice connection. This year is also the 50th anniversary of the first launch of a gamma-ray satellite. Explorer 11 was launched in April 1961 and was sent to gamma rays above 50 MeV, operated for only about 7 months, pictured a whole 22 gamma rays in that time, and of course a large number of cosmic rays. And this is just a picture showing how the mission operated. It's actually in a tumbling motion, so it was slewing the sky and then slewing, looking at the Earth at the same time. Nice to have that tie between Parkes dish and gamma-ray astronomy. There were, of course, a number of follow-up missions. There were some more before SAS-2, but there's a lot of progress before EGRIT was made by SAS-2, a fairly short mission that did observe half the celestial sphere, identified the first point sources. And I was just looking at this paper in the last week or so and found that no AGN were detected, but upper limits were set for a number of sources, including all the prime suspects. So Markarian 421, Markarian 501, 3C273, SEN-A, were all examined, but the sensitivity of SAS-2 was just not good enough to detect those. But they have gone on to be detected by EGRET and then Fermi. And then COSB, a longer mission, most of the exposure to the galactic plane, but a possible detection of a couple of extragalactic sources. My one-page summary of the conclusions from the EGRET era, reflecting my personal biases, the big surprise, of course, was that AGN are bright variable gamma-ray sources. I remember Dave Thompson saying to me, look, we knew the pulsars were going to be detected by EGRID, and so we had a big campaign of monitoring pulsars with ground-based facilities. But the surprise was that there were so many AGN emitting gamma rays, as EGRID found, so that we were sort of one step behind in monitoring all these AGN when EGRID was launched. Gamma ray high state, accompanied by a flare of millimeter wave, thanks to an ejection of a new and often superluminal component on the plastic scale, of course, it's just reviewed that very nicely for us. In the EGRID era, the timing, relative timing of these events was unclear, and so the light we could show on the physical process was also limited. Identifications were mainly made with Jansky level sources, a reflection of the error boxes on the EGRID detections, and there remained many unidentified sources. And AGN were more variable at gamma ray energies than other classes, but one of the big conclusions was that better sky coverage and more sensitivity was required, and that's why we have Fermi today. So just looking at some of your individual highlights, this was looking at the timing of flares with respect to the radio. This is Metsahobi 22 and 37 gigahertz data. The vertical lines here are when this source, ARC-04 20-014, was in the EGRID field of view. There are actually five lines here, but they're fairly closely spaced. And the red lines correspond to the EGRID detections of this source. And as we've already heard, they occur preferentially at the rising stage of a millimeter flare or in a high state when there are a number of flares superimposed. But not every time that the source is looked at. And the counterexample in this paper by Valtoria Giostranto was 1156 plus 295 when it wasn't a 1EG source and it was in a fairly low state, not a lot of activity, and so not too surprisingly wasn't detected. Had it been looked at perhaps over here, had there been a gamma ray satellite up, and then the suspicion was that it may well have been detected. And that was nicely vindicated by the second EGRID catalogue, which in fact found that it was a gamma ray source. That is the viewing period where it was detected, right in the middle of a rising millimeter flare, as predicted. But the mysteries remain. One of our favourite southern sources is Parkes 1921-293. Which did all the right things during the EGRID era. Some fantastic flares, up to 20-odd Jansky, so it's a 3C279 like in its brightness, but not seen by EGRID at all. And that was a mystery at the time. We couldn't understand why a source like this wouldn't be a gamma ray source. And, of course, with Fermi now up there monitoring it more frequently, we know that it is just at the right time. Moving on to some of the EGRID identifications. Identifications with EGRID sources were made on the obvious things, proximity from the sky, radio brightness, the brighter it is, the fewer sources of that that magnitude in the area, and spectral index. But the problem is rarely with contemporaneous data. The surprise is that this actually works so well without contemporaneous data, but a lot of the physics it can be revealed by having contemporaneous data for these. So I just want to present a couple of slides that Dave McConnell presented at the meeting last week on some reanalysis of some work done on one of these all-sky surveys. The CRATES catalogue is based mainly on the 87 Greenbank, or GB6, and PMN, Parkes MIT NRAO surveys. And there was a follow-up survey to the single-dish PMN survey done with the compact array, which Dave has been reanalyzing. This is just a plot of all the sky covered by those two surveys, and actually the galactic plane isn't here and was fully monitored, but there are a couple of missing spots in this all-sky survey, which is worth bearing in mind. But the compact array data was a follow-up of the brighter sources, and Dave has gone back and done a careful reanalysis based on better positions of the phase calibrators, the calibrators for this survey, and found a lot more sources, and done a quick analysis of the compact array follow-up to the PMN with the Fermi second catalogue, and found that indeed there are a whole bunch of sources, as identified in the two-lane catalogue, over an expected background, just by shifting the positions, and he can actually do a statistical analysis, look at the offsets in positions, and work out probably what the real identifications are in amongst them. One paper that came out of the Egret era, which is very undecided, I think, for its conclusions, is one by Isla Shakra and Burtenshaw, who looked at the fractional radio polarization from NDSS data to identify egret sources. Higher polarization leads to a higher probability of correct identification, and they had limited data. All other things being equal, you'd probably want to look at fractional radio polarization at a higher frequency. But they had some success in examining a number of sources and comparing those with 2EG sources. A number of the identified 2EG sources now have disappeared and probably weren't real to start with. But they did have some success with this technique, and so that's one worth bearing in mind for future identifications. And the other point, of course, is the simultaneity of the importance of simultaneity of data. This is 3C279, from UM RAO. Here's the percentage polarization, and you can see that the percentage polarization goes up and down. And in fact, if you would look at it here, you'd actually claim this was a low polarized source and may wrongly conclude that it's not actually a good candidate for it to be a counterpart to an egret source. During the very bright flare in the late 90s, the polarization also dropped off as well. And so, emphasizing the importance of simultaneous data. Okay, next little category I want to just touch on is the passing scale structure. And again, Thomas has covered this in more detail. High gamma ray fluxes tend to be correlated with the ejection of new components. Perhaps here, the definitive case for egret was the fact that my first data is out. However, the limited time coverage of the egret observations didn't enable us to know whether all component injections were accompanied by, or all VLBI component injections were accompanied by gamma ray high states, and vice versa, were all VLBI component injections accompanied by a gamma ray high state. And this is this is actually the TV monitoring of Markarian 501 over 5 years. Markarian 501 was detected that year at a fairly low level, and bobbled along at that level for the first couple of years, and then 1997 had an ongoing series of dramatic flaring events, which continued into 1998. And now we might expect that activity like that has to produce something visible in VLBI images. And this is a plot from some work I did with Glenn Pioneer, showing that there are a number of jet components that we can trace, but nothing appears to have emerged from the core in 1997. There's no obvious new component coming out as a result of that. So why is that so? Why don't all gamma ray flares result in that new component emerging? Last one I want to touch on was intraday variability. This comes from the annual review article of Wagner and Witzel. 1995, the gamma ray regime has become accessible. One of the early results was that gamma ray sources are radio loud objects. The All-Sky survey led to the discovery of 25 lasers, most of which are already known to be intraday variable sources in their optical and radio regimes. Conversely, a large fraction of the common radio IVD sources are strong emitters of gamma rays. So this apparent connection between radio intraday variability and gamma ray brightness was known quite early on. This is just one example of radio intraday variability in the gamma ray source, Park 1632 minus 297. This is long-term monitoring. This is over a year and a half or so here at two different radio frequencies, 4.8, 8.6 gigahertz. And you can see there's long-term variability, but we can also see from the spread of error bars here, there's actually quite pronounced variability over the course of just a day or so at radio frequencies. So what's that telling us? The question, of course, is this variability intrinsic to the source, or is it a propagation effect that's extrinsic to the source? Some intraday variables have an annual cycle where the intraday variability is modulated by the Earth's motion around the Sun. So this annual cycle of intraday variability in some sources is clear evidence that the interstellar scintillation is the cause. It's an extrinsic effect. However, there are other sources where there appears to be correlated radio and optical intraday variability, which say of intrinsic origin. But at some level, it doesn't matter whether it's extrinsic or intrinsic, because the conclusion is there must be a very compact component in either case, whatever the explanation. And so these gamma ray sources appear to have a very compact component, which could potentially be a new jet component emerging from the core. One of the biggest systematic studies of intraday availability is this massive survey of over 400 sources done at the VLA, but there is the potential to do a lot more work in this field. However, if you have a limited time allocation on your radio telescope, there's an obvious trade-off between monitoring a large number of sources at a large number of frequencies or monitoring those a large number of times to search for intraday variability. So some trade-off needs to be made between those. Okay, just a few concluding remarks. Fermi provides great improvements in, among other things, the angular resolution, the sensitivity, and the sky coverage. And that's fantastic. But if you had to choose between just one of those, one EGRIT and just one of these improvements, which one would you go for? Well, I would show my bias by saying I think it's the sky coverage. The fact that we see one of these sources every day means we're getting a much better idea of how to correlate the gamma ray activity with variability of other wavelengths. One of the interesting questions that came up at the Parkes Symposium last week was one of the pulsar astronomers said, look, there was such a great improvement from EGRIT to Fermi. Are you guys working on another satellite which is going to be another step forward from Fermi? Can we do better than Fermi? And the answer at the time was, well, not easily. The techniques developed for the Fermi satellite can be tweaked, can be improved slightly, but there is probably no quantum leap to be made in the near future. And hopefully the corollary of that is not that it's going to be harder to sell a follow-up mission, because there's a lot more that we can learn from ongoing studies. We are much better placed, as we've already heard from Thomas, with complementary radio and other volunteering and other wavelengths as Fermi. So there's a lot of good work we are doing and continue to do. And so where does that leave us? Well, my conclusion is that that leaves us, again, it's a bit dark, but leaves us on top of the world, celebrating 50 years of the gamma ray astronomy, 50 years of the telescope, and looking forward to the next 50 years of gamma ray astronomy. Thank you.
Orbit is only good in 2050, so it can really only have